Hey, it's great having Caden with us in the house today. Appreciate him leading worship, and that gave Pastor Josh some time to be literally in the house checking some things and checking some systems, which made me think as we were worshiping, I should probably ask you to pray, obviously for the move, the relocation, but one of the things I may not have specifically asked you to pray for is technology. Our new facility is state of the art. In every way, in every classroom, you have television monitors, direct plug and play for all of our teachers who teach in our small groups. We have just an immense amount of technology in the children's area and in the worship center. And there's going to be a really steep learning curve this summer. So just continue to pray for the technology, pray that it all gets installed properly, works properly, and that everybody involved in that process gets all the training and everything necessary so that we can this fall really enjoy being in the new building. And it was great having Caden with us to step in. So that gave Pastor Josh the chance to be out and about some in the house and up in the booth and some other areas looking at different things that were taking place. We love it. I love it when Casey preaches because it gives me a chance to be out and we don't necessarily have to be in this moment. We love what we do. Don't want to miss it. I don't want anybody to misunderstand. Go home and say, Pastor James doesn't want to preach and Pastor Josh doesn't want to lead worship. What are we paying them for? No, it's not that at all, but it's great to not necessarily have that responsibility and be able to interact with everyone and be able to interact with everything that's taking place. One more reminder, Easter is going to be amazing. It's going to be amazingly crowded and fun because we're all going to be in here. One service, open doors at 9:30, 10 o'clock is when the service will kick off, but there's all kinds of pre-service activity, handbell choir, children's activities. Some students are going to be, I think, helping in some different areas. Everybody is going to have opportunities to serve that morning. We want you to be a part. Yard signs, I know, are in the front lobby. I think they've also transitioned some to this back lobby. Be sure to take those with you, put them out in your yards. But look forward to it and anticipate all that's going to happen on that great day as we celebrate the power we have in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Let me give you just a word of warning. If you ever watched maybe a movie, a miniseries, or even sometimes a regular series, and they're building the story, and it's one kind of negative thing after another, one bad thing after another, one disturbing thing after another, and then it comes to a conclusion. Right at the point you think you're going to resolve and it's going to get good, it comes to a conclusion and you're told you have to wait to see the next one. And you're watching live, so you can't just binge it and go roll into the next one. You literally have to wait. That's what today is. Everything about today's message is going to be hard, it's going to be difficult, it's going to sound negative, and it's going to be stuff that we struggle with. James is going to be addressing basically the character of our lives and how it reflects who we are and how we live our lives and the direction we make decisions to go in. And we don't have enough time to get through all of that to get to the positive side. So we're going to only look at the negative side of things. And I apologize for that up front, because we try to actually leave out of here with a proactive stance on what we can do, what we should be able to implement. Basically, what happens here should make a difference tomorrow morning at work or at school or at home. And that's going to be a little difficult this week. So I'm just going to tell you right up front, we're going to end today somewhat unresolved. But the good news is, we come back next week and we look at all the really good stuff and we don't have any negative stuff next week. So feel free to come back. Hey, Caden, if you just want to catch, you and Paige come back next Sunday as well. It's not that far of a commute from College Station. What do y'all think? Just commute? He's a successful businessman and I keep trying to convince him to be bivocational and come on staff with us in some form or another. So we'll just have to see if we can work that out. So hang in there with me today. And know that there are better things on the horizon. James is going to address a critical issue. It was relevant in the first century AD. In some ways, I think it's probably even more relevant in the 21st century. Because he's going to address the way in which we let our lives be dictated or guided by the events or circumstances, and especially the filters we put in place on how we want to live, how we make decisions. Let's look at the passage. We're in James chapter 3. We're down in verse 13. And you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, of how this whole first section is pretty rough. But like I said, Pastor Josh and I discussed it. We decided to break it into 2 weeks. So just bear with me. James says, who among you is wise and understanding? Now, let me just give you a real quick qualification. We'll look at this in more depth. When he's talking about wise and understanding, he's talking about spiritual wisdom versus unspiritual wisdom. He's talking about wisdom that comes from God versus wisdom that's part of this world. Who among you is wise and understanding? By his good conduct, he should show that his works are done in the gentleness that comes from wisdom, which is ultimately from God. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't boast and deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there is disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peace-loving, gentle, compliant, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without pretense. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who cultivate peace. James is advocating, and he's going to do it with a series of words to describe characteristics, to describe the nature of which we look at something and determine something, and the indications of what that means for our position in this world. And then those characteristics that manifest, because that's the framework by which we're making our decisions, it manifests itself in our character. And then lastly, he will look at, in each case, he will look at the results of that, what that actually ends up doing to our world, to our lives, to our work, to our school, to our families, to our homes, to our lives, even individually. And it's these filters that are going to make the decision whether it is a good experience, whether it is a positive experience, whether it is something we can emulate and live in such a way that it encourages and influences others, or whether it's something that is destructive, hazardous, toxic, and as a result ultimately ends up destroying us and is characteristic not of the things of God, but the things of this world, which are inherently unspiritual. And it's going to be difficult because as we go through this, this is essentially a word study. Understand this. The New Testament is written in the Greek language. Three primary languages in the Bible. The Old Testament is Hebrew. During kind of what we call the intertestamental stage, the Gospels and some of the things you see in those historical accounts of Jesus, you see references that are made in Aramaic. But the majority of the New Testament is written in Greek. I don't spend a lot of time discussing that. We come across in our study occasionally words that are complex and difficult because Greek is much more defined and much more exhaustive than English is. But that's not the case. James isn't using complex Greek words that have nuances and multiple meanings. He's using common everyday Greek. James is at least bilingual, if not trilingual. He's the pastor of the church in Jerusalem. He has an extensive Hebrew background. He's the half-brother of Jesus. He has a full background in Hebrew, and he's going to be significantly influenced in this passage of Scripture from the Hebrew wisdom literature. Things like Song of Solomon's and Ecclesiastes and the book of Proverbs and even some of the Psalms. And so you're going to get that feel. If you've read through the book of Proverbs, you're going to have that feel as you look at this. Doing so, he uses multiple words to make his point. So we're essentially doing a word study. We're looking at the words he's using and how those words impact and also indicate the nature of our life. And so his very first question, who among you is wise and understanding? Is a simple question. Who among you has spiritual wisdom? Wisdom in Scripture always refers to a spiritual basis of that wisdom. But James is almost comprehensive in this passage of Scripture because he says not only wise, but his understanding, which is a word that describes what we would think of in terms of knowledge or learning or education. And so you could literally say who's wise or who's smart, who has wisdom that is actually from God, that it's a spiritual wisdom that helps us live our life, and who has the simple knowledge and the ability to formulate that into a life that's taking place. And so the question is out in a very real sense to the whole group of people. Who among us is wise and understanding? He's going to build his case that truly wise and understanding people are spiritual people. People connected with, in relationship with God, and implementing the truth, the precepts, the guidance of God into their life. And that's the case he's going to build over the next 2 weeks as we look at these passages. And he describes it, as we've heard over and over in James, that it is characterized by good conduct, which simply means our work and our behavior. It's the question we've asked from the very beginning, as I point to a blank screen. It's the question we've asked from the very beginning: how is our faith demonstrated in an authentic fashion? How is our faith made real in our behavior? And that's exactly what he's describing. By his good conduct, by his works, by his behavior, demonstrated through gentleness, which is just humility. It's the gentle deeds. It is the gentle nature of a loving and compassionate God. These things become evident and these things become real wisdom. And so we begin looking at these as markers, as a means by which we guide and navigate through life. And the wise and understanding individual trusts and uses the markers. Real good friend of mine took me fishing for years and years and years. Love fishing on the bay. Love being out there. Love being on the water. It's a great time. If you leave Galveston Bay, headed out into the Gulf, as you do that, there are literal markers along the ship channel. On your starboard side, your right side, there are green markers. On your port side, on the left side, there are red markers. They are there and they are designed so that in any set of circumstances, you know which is the right direction. You know which is the pathway that needs to be followed. You traverse through that, you navigate through that with safety and assurance because somebody has gone ahead and charted the course and placed that in there. It's simple navigation. And you need it on the bay. You need it whether you're in a small fishing craft like ours or whether you're in a massive tanker or you're in a massive cruise ship. You need to know right where the channel is, because as soon as the channel ends, it's shallow water again. You need to know the correct direction to go, and your circumstances are always changing. I mean, I've been on the bay so many times when you literally cannot see more than just a few feet. The fog rolls in off of the Gulf. You can't see anything. And the only way you have guidance in those moments where you're blinded are those markers. Now, here's the issue and here's the difficulty, and this is what James is going to begin to discuss in verse 14, is if somebody moves the markers, your threshold for safety is no longer intact. Or if somebody says, well, who had the authority to place those markers? Let's remove them, or let's reallocate them, or let's change it. Let's turn the green ones to red and the red ones to green. Everything is in jeopardy. And let me tell you what happens, because it's obvious in the bay. Any of us that have ever fished the bay, you know this. People that disregard the markers, people that disregard the depth soundings, people that disregard what is known as chartered effective courses, shipwreck. And there's all kinds of fishing boats. There's all kinds of shrimping boats. There's even tankers that have gone off track in the bay, and they're still in the bay. And they are nothing but new habitat for fish. As fishermen, we appreciate it because it gives us good places to fish. But if you're living your life, the last thing you want to do, you have a brand new bay boat, the last thing you want to do is run it up onto a reef, collapse it, and then leave it there so I can go fishing next year in the new habitat your $60,000 boat just created. It makes sense to want to follow the markers and to guard your navigation. But wisdom from the world begins to change that. And that's where we get things like relative truth, and that's where we get the ideas and concept that there is no absolute truth. Nobody has the authority, nobody has the right to say, this is absolutely true. And of course, we disregard God in that same scenario as well. And then we shipwreck our lives and we stand there like, what happened? What went wrong? How come my life's so miserable? I got so much freedom. I don't have to do all those restraints. And all it did was shipwreck us. And James begins to describe that. In verse 14, he says, but if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your heart, so you move towards, he is moving towards his case against being unwise or ultimately unspiritual. Bitter envy describes jealousy. It describes intense jealousy. It describes harboring on those hard feelings, letting those feelings now guide and direct and filter all of your decisions. He includes with those bitter feelings selfish ambition. This is literally an insatiable desire. It's an insatiable desire for position. It creates strife. It creates this kind of in-depth rivalry. And you know, you see it all the time. That kind of ambition, it ruins sports teams. It ruins school. It ruins workplaces. All of us have worked in places where everybody's just at one another's throats. And we don't, it's not a pleasant atmosphere. And you're sitting here today thinking, I wish James would stop talking about work tomorrow because I don't want to go. Because the atmosphere is toxic. And we know that it's toxic. We know that it's hazardous. We feel obligated. We feel constrained. We may even have a legitimate level of necessity that requires we go because that's how God's going to provide for us. We understand that, but we know that it's wrong and we know that it's toxic and we know that it's hazardous. And this bitter envy, this selfish ambition, that becomes the new filter. I had a somewhat amazing experience this past month. Many of you know, maybe news to some of you, but I had to have cataract surgery in the month of February. And so they went in, did surgery on my eyes. They did one eye first, one eye the next. I still can't see. The good news is I'm hoping this week to make it to the doctor. I'm hoping this week to get a new prescription. I'm hoping next week to have glasses, and I'll be able to actually read from a real Bible instead of a digital Bible. I'll be able to actually see. I'll be able to look in the back and know that you're actually here because I can't see you right now. You're just kind of this blurred feel that I'm looking at. With all the issues of focus, in focus, out of focus, nearsighted, far, with all those sight issues, the one that surprised me the most was color. Color and brightness. I had absolutely no idea that the cataracts had changed literally the lens of my eye and had literally changed the filter by which I could see and ultimately which determined what I thought was right. The doctor never mentioned it. The surgeon never mentioned it. I was checking out, and the business administrator mentioned to me, you're going to be amazed at the brightness, and warned me, actually said, you're going to be a little overwhelmed at the brightness. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And told me, you know, my mother, when she had cataract surgery is something us old people go through. So you have it to look forward to, but you don't have to worry about it this week. She said, you'll be shocked, you know, because leaves will be distinct on trees and it'll be a brighter green and whites will be whiter whites. And I'm like, I'm not having issues with color. I'm not having issues with brightness. I can't focus. I had a very narrow perspective on what I thought my vision reality was. I was absolutely floored. After they'd only do one eye at a time, so they did the first eye. After they did the first eye, the next day, I finally get to take all the bandages off and everything, and I get to open my eyes, and I am overwhelmed. I mean, the warnings were inadequate. The brightness of the room was absolutely stunning, almost painful. I was completely shocked. Because I had been thinking for months and been kind of a little afraid to mention it to Carrie that we need to repaint our house. Because all the walls are so dingy and so dirty, so nasty looking. I could close one eye and look through the other eye. I could change the color of my house. If I close my left eye, my house is white. I just want you to know, she cleans the house all the time. It turns out the paint's not white. I mean, the paint is white. It's not dingy tan. My filter had redefined for me what was reality, and it had redefined it incorrectly. I was absolutely amazed. Second day after surgery, I had to run to Lowe's and buy safety glasses that were tinted because I literally couldn't drive if the sun was shining. It was so brilliant through my right eye that didn't have the filter, didn't have the cloud, didn't have the disease obscuring my vision. I had gone along, all along, assuming everything I saw, everything I believed was absolutely right, absolutely true, and absolutely the condition of the world. Only to find out that everyone else in the world saw it right and I was the only one that was wrong. Because my filters had changed. And that's what happens with both bitter envy and that's what happens with selfish ambition. These things change the filter. You've heard the expression, or you've read it in literature, the idea, the concept of viewing life through rose-colored glasses, which is supposed to indicate in some form or fashion that you view life in a positive, loving, kind of just everything's good. While that may be true, the reality is that issues like bitter envy, issues like selfish ambition, it taints, it colors, it changes the filter of our life in those directions which ultimately are harmful and are negative. And so I begin to see and I begin to process everything in my life through that bitterness. And I hear this all the time. You know, well, churches are this, churches are that. I mean, I hear complaints about churches all the time. And I'll ask somebody, why is a church that way? Why do you think church is going to be that way? Why do you think that's your experience at church? Well, because at such and such. Yeah, you had a bad experience one time at church. And you've let that change the color of your reality. And you're wrong. The church is the brilliancy of God to give us community and encouragement and strength as we learn more about Him. But I had a bad experience, and now it is applied to everything I see. And everyone else who thinks differently from me is wrong. We do this in our relationships. We do this in our pursuit of our own happiness and joy. It impacts us. That selfish ambition, that absolute uncontrollable desire to be in a position or to be in a place, to be in a position that is superior to everybody else, and to have absolute authority. It filters, it changes everything. And we have to stop. James is challenging us and asking us, stop and look. What are the filters that we're looking at through life? I'm being completely honest when I say, prior to surgery, if you had asked me, I would have absolutely told you. I would have told you the light coming off of stage right is tinted in a tan fashion. I would have even given you, I made up excuses to justify my filters. Well, Josh does that on purpose so that it doesn't bounce off of our ultra white skin and it doesn't become a glaring thing to you. Josh is tinting it on purpose. I mean, we did this. The second day after my surgery, I picked up my iPad to read it because everything I'm reading lately has been off of my iPad because I couldn't see regular books. And I looked at it and I looked at Carrie and said, hey, did you know our iPad screens are white? I have actually thought that my Kindle screen was parchment on purpose. I thought it was a plot from Barnes & Noble to make everything digitally look like an old book. I thought it was creative. I've even stood up for it. Oh, I love it. It doesn't strain my eyes. No, absolutely. All that was wrong. It's actually white. But I couldn't see it. Bitter envy and selfish ambition do this to us. And James is just saying, stop for a moment and look and recognize what you are examining, what you're seeing, and be gentle enough, be humble enough to look at it and recognize maybe my filter is actually incorrect. He says these filters change, and he begins to talk about characteristics. In the latter part of verse 14, he says, don't boast or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. Boasting is exactly how it sounds. It literally means an arrogance that is self-serving in its pride. It is the assumption that I am the master of my life. It is the assumption that I am the absolute authority. It is the assumption that I am the dean or chancellor of my life and my thought process. It is the assumption that I am the president of how I want to manage and navigate my life, that I am absolutely, ultimately in control. And it sounds good at first. When you first hear it, I don't need anybody. I don't depend on anybody, especially if I'm filtering through bitter envy or selfish ambition, because there's no room for anybody. I don't trust anybody, and I don't want to trust anybody because there's only room at the top for one, and I've already decided that one is me. And so everything's about me. And so you begin to then boast. You begin to operate and function out of a self-serving pride, and you assume I have absolute control. And so when we talk about God actually being who God is, we have to either accept that position of authority and submit to it, or we stand in rebellion to it. The next phrase is absolutely critical in the 21st century. He says, don't boast or deny the truth. This word literally means lying against the truth. This is where the concept of relative truth comes into place. It's a reflection of our defiance of the truth. If the truth contradicts what I want to believe or what I want to do, then the easiest thing for me to do is to determine that the truth doesn't exist. And so we begin by thinking it's situational or it's relative, and I can redefine the truth. I am offended by green lights, and so I'm going to redefine the green lights on my starboard, and I'm going to beach and shipwreck. I question who had the right to determine that. Who had the authority to determine that I need to keep my ship in between the green lights and the red lights? And I begin to think I don't need to have any regard toward it. I didn't give them the authority to do that. I didn't give them. We do this all the time. Who had the authority to set the speed limit? Who had the authority to determine that this drug was illegal or illicit in some fashion? Who had the authority to say, I needed to do this? Who has the authority to say that I need to study this? Who has the authority? Does my boss really have the authority to tell me this is what I'm expected to do? I am my own master. I am my own king. And the only way I can be that king is to begin redefining the realities around me from my perspective. But the problem is I'm filtered. I'm looking at it, and it's the wrong color, and it's the wrong distinctions. And now I'm doing all of this from my own perspective. There, all relative truth gives you permission to do is wreck your life, destroy your life. Because you don't want to follow any absolutes? Ironically, you don't have to. God's not going to make you do it. God's not going to say, you have no choice. This is what you've got to do. He will let you shipwreck your life. But here is the reality. If we want to navigate this life correctly, if we want to navigate this life safely, if we want to navigate this life effectively, then we need the markers. We need the lines on the road. We need the traffic signs on the side. We need the guidance. We need the direction that comes from above. And that's exactly how James describes it. This truth that is arrogant and boasting, this truth that lies against real truth and creates its own truth, is by its nature earthly. And that doesn't mean it tastes good in a cup of coffee. It means that it has a horizontal perspective. It has no regard for anything that might be above or beyond us. And so it's fully and completely only earthly. It is horizontal, it is material, it is temporal, it is worldly, and it is ultimately sensual, because what motivates us most is what we feel. Whether that's feeling for hunger, or whether that's feeling for thirst, or feeling for attention, or feeling for affection, whatever that feeling is, it is the primary motivator in our lives. And without any guidance, without any markers, without any direction where hazard is, then we just float and we drift aimlessly until we wreck. And that's what worldly truth provides for us. That's what cultural truth provides for us. It's a horizontal perspective without any relationship to God. That's why the first thing anybody does that wants to follow through with an idea of relative truth, the first thing they want to do is remove God from the scenario. So you take down the Ten Commandments, because we wouldn't want any little children to be offended by being told they shouldn't murder, or they shouldn't commit adultery, or they shouldn't lie, or they shouldn't steal, or that they should have, God forbid, if we can use that phrase, an allegiance to a one true God. So let's remove it. So what do we do next? Everybody's got it. Nobody needs to be offended. And so we don't pray. We take down the markers. We start removing the lines. We begin to redefine from our inaccurate and inadequate filter. And it's earthly. It's horizontal in nature. And it is, as you would already expect it to be, unspiritual. Because it is a natural self-orientation. We pull God out of the scenario. We no longer have a vertical axis. It's only a horizontal axis. And now we assume that that makes us in the right place, in the proper position, with all the correct authority to determine for ourselves what is reality. And in doing so, we become unspiritual. Even all the things that claim spirituality, all the natural things that have been developed over the years, which are actually all old. I mean, there's nothing new. There's nothing new in this life. There's nothing new now. Are in reality not spiritual. Or worse yet, they're so natural that they're up for grabs, and he makes it obvious and says, not only is it unspiritual, but it is actually demonic. Now, he's not talking about just little evil spirits. He's talking about it is literally endorsed by, it is approved by, it is a part of Satan's attempt to destroy anything that might be reflective of God. There are kingdoms in conflict. God's kingdom is conflict with Satan's kingdom. And Satan has been granted temporarily control in this world. Now, nothing's out of God's control. Satan still has to ask permission to do things. But he's been granted for this period of time. And these worlds come into conflict. And it's spiritual versus unspiritual. And either you are with God or you're without God. And to be without God is to be a part of Satan's kingdom. We just don't talk about it, and nobody wants to admit it. Nobody wants to deal with it. Nobody wants to cope with it because it becomes too obvious. How many of you heard? Every political season, you hear ads, and the ads say this, 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 whatever they're wanting to say. At the end of the ad, they're required by the Federal Communications Commission, they are required to say, and this is James Clark, and I approve this ad, because I am held ultimately accountable for my own political statements. Can you imagine? You go to school tomorrow morning, and somebody says, you know what? Don't worry about this whole concept that God made you. Just be a part of this world. Don't worry about your identity, because it's up for grabs. We went through and we removed every marker. You don't have to worry about green lights or red lights. Do whatever you want. Think whatever you want. You don't have to worry about your future. Just do what feels best for you. And at the end of that conversation, how would it feel? What would be your response when your teacher looks up and suddenly a voice comes over the speaker and says, oh, by the way, this is Satan, and I approve this philosophy. If we were honest, we wouldn't believe any of the garbage that we're confronted with every single day. Because it's exactly as James describes it. It's boastful, it's arrogant, it denies truth, it's horizontal only, it's only of this world. It takes into no account a loving, caring God who's in his compassion, wants the very best for us, and we get the very best by listening to him and following him and trusting him. And the picture of his best is not best at all. That's what verse 16 is. For where there is envy, where there is selfish ambition, there is disorder and every evil practice. Disorder just literally means what it sounds like: chaos, confusion, disharmony, pettiness, antagonism. Everything that makes your life miserable isn't actually from God. He's not to blame. We're to blame. We started changing the markers. We started coloring and changing the filters by which we made decisions. And then we wonder, why are things so chaotic? Why is everybody so mean? Why is there so much violence? Why? Because we started changing everything. We started redefining it the way we wanted it, the way we thought would be the best to elevate us, even over God. And it's not only chaotic, but it's actually, his expression for evil practice is everything vile, everything that's just evil in its intention. I want you to think about it the next time. The next time you're confronted with a decision that contradicts what you believe about who God is and what you've learned in Scripture, I want you to hear that voice that says, this is Satan, and I endorse this. Interestingly enough, James is not addressing an unchristian crowd. He is talking to the church. I have the tendency, I think a lot of us have the tendency in moments like this to think, oh yeah, this is all those other evil people. If the church had done what the church was supposed to do, the markers never would have been changed. If the church had done what the church was supposed to do, we wouldn't look at the carnage of the shipwrecks every time we open our feeds. If the church was doing what God wanted it to do, then his kingdom would be prevailing. It's our responsibility. We need the surgery. We need that tinted, diseased lens removed. And we need the brightness of God's truth. And we need the clarity of God's truth to lead us and to guide us and to help us make the right decisions. And that's where I have to leave it. But I promise, next week is better. Father,